Chapter 10. The great French duel. I second Gambetta in a terrific duel. Much as the modern French duel is ridiculed by certain smart people, it is in reality one of the most dangerous institutions of our day. Since it is always fought in the open air, the combatants are nearly sure to catch cold. M. Paul de Cassagnac, the most inveterate of the French duelists, had suffered so often in this way that he is at last a confirmed invalid. And the best physician in Paris has expressed the opinion that if he goes on dueling for 15 or 20 years more, unless he forms the habit of fighting in a comfortable room where damps and drafts cannot intrude, he will eventually endanger his life. This ought to moderate the talk of those people who are so stubborn in maintaining that the French duel is the most health-giving of recreations because of the open-air exercise it affords. And it ought also to moderate that foolish talk about French duelists and socialist-hated monarchs being the only people who are immoral. But it is time to get at my subject. As soon as I heard of the late fiery outbreak between M. Gambetta and M. Fertu in the French Assembly, I knew that trouble must follow. I knew it because a long personal friendship with M. Gambetta revealed to me the desperate and implacable nature of the man. Vast as are his physical proportions, I knew that the thirst for revenge would penetrate to the remotest frontiers of his person. I did not wait for him to call on me, but went at once to him. As I had expected, I found the brave fellow steeped in a profound French calm. I say French calm, because French calmness and English calmness have points of difference. He was moving swiftly back and forth among the debris of his furniture, now and then staving chance fragments of it across the room with his foot, grinding a constant crisp of curses through his set teeth, and halting every little while to deposit another handful of his hair on the pile which he had been building of it on the table. He threw his arms around my neck, bent me over his stomach to his breast, kissed me on both cheeks, hugged me four or five times, and then placed me in his own armchair. As soon as I had got well again, we began business at once. I said I supposed he would wish me to act as his second, and he said, "Of course." I said I must be allowed to act under a French name, so that I might be shielded from obloquy in my country, in case of fatal results. He winced here, probably at the suggestion that dueling was not regarded with respect in America. However, he agreed to my requirement. This accounts for the fact that in all the newspaper reports M. Gambetta II was apparently a Frenchman. First, we drew up my principal's will. I insisted upon this, and stuck to my point. I said I had never heard of a man in his right mind going out to fight a duel without first making his will. He said he had never heard of a man in his right mind doing anything of the kind. When he had finished the will, he wished to proceed to a choice of his last words. He wanted to know how the following words, as a dying exclamation, struck me. "I die for my God, for my country, for freedom of speech, for progress, and the universal brotherhood of man." I objected that this would require too lingering a death. It was a good speech for a consumptive, but not suited to the exigencies of the field of honor. We wrangled over a good many anti-mortem outbursts, but I finally got him to cut his obituary down to this, which he copied into his memorandum book, purposing to get it by heart. "I die that France might live." I said that this remark seemed to lack relevancy, but he said relevancy was a matter of no consequence in last words. What he wanted was thrill. The next thing in order was the choice of weapons. My principal said he was not feeling well, and would leave that and the other details of the proposed meeting to me. Therefore I wrote the following note, and carried it to M. Fertu's friend. "Sir, M. Gambetta accepts M. Fertu's challenge, and authorizes me to propose Plessis Piquet as the place of meeting, tomorrow morning at daybreak as the time, and axes as the weapons. I am, sir, with great respect, Mark Twain." M. Fertu's friend read this note, and shuddered. Then he turned to me, and said, with a suggestion of severity in his tone, Have you considered, sir, what would be the inevitable result of such a meeting as this? Well, for instance, what would it be? Bloodshed. That's about the size of it, I said. Ah, if it is a fair question, what was your side proposing to shed? I had him there. He saw he had made a blunder, so he hastened to explain it away. He said he had spoken jestingly. Then he added that he and his principal would enjoy axes, and indeed prefer them, but such weapons were barred by the French code, and so I must change my proposal. I walked the floor, turning the thing over in my mind, and finally it occurred to me that Gatling guns at 15 paces would be a likely way to get a verdict on the field of honor. So I framed this idea into a proposition. But it was not accepted. The code was in the way again. I proposed rifles, then double-barreled shotguns, then Colt's Navy revolvers. These being all rejected, I reflected a while, and sarcastically suggested brickbats at 3/4 of a mile. I always hate to fool away a humorous thing on a person who has no perception of humor, and it filled me with bitterness when this man went soberly away to submit the last proposition to his principal. He came back presently, and said his principal was charmed with the idea of brickbats at 3/4 of a mile, but must decline on account of the danger to disinterested parties passing between them. Then I said, well, I am at the end of my string now. Perhaps you would be good enough to suggest a weapon? Perhaps you have even had one in your mind all the time? His countenance brightened, and he said with alacrity, oh, without doubt, monsieur. So he fell to hunting in his pockets, pocket after pocket, and he had plenty of them, muttering all the while, now, what could I have done with them? At last he was successful. He fished out of his vest pocket a couple of little things which I carried to the light and ascertained to be pistols. They were single-barreled and silver-mounted, and very dainty and pretty. I was not able to speak for emotion. I silently hung one of them on my watch chain, and returned the other. My companion in crime now unrolled a postage stamp containing several cartridges, and gave me one of them. I asked if he meant to signify by this that our men were to be allowed but one shot apiece. He replied that the French code permitted no more. I then begged him to go and suggest a distance, for my mind was growing weak and confused under the strain which had been put upon it. He named 65 yards. I nearly lost my patience. I said, 65 yards, with these instruments? Squirt guns would be deadlier at 50. Consider, my friend, you and I are banded together to destroy life, not make it eternal. But with all my persuasions, all my arguments, I was only able to get him to reduce the distance to 35 yards, and even this concession he made with reluctance, and said with a sigh, I wash my hands of this slaughter, on your head be it. There was nothing for me but to go home to my old lion heart and tell my humiliating story. When I entered, M. Gambetta was laying his last lock of hair upon the altar. He sprang toward me, exclaiming, you have made the fatal arrangements, I see it in your eye. I have. His face paled a trifle, and he leaned upon the table for support. He breathed thick and heavily for a moment or two, so tumultuous were his feelings. Then he hoarsely whispered, the weapon, quick, what is the weapon? This. And I displayed that silver-mounted thing. He cast but one glance at it, then swooned ponderously to the floor. When he came to, he said mournfully, the unnatural calm to which I have subjected myself has told upon my nerves. But away with weakness. I will confront my fate like a man and a Frenchman. He rose to his feet, and assumed an attitude which for sublimity has never been approached by man, and has seldom been surpassed by statues. Then he said, in his deep bass tones, behold, I am calm, I am ready, reveal to me the distance. 35 yards. ... I could not lift him up, of course. But I rolled him over, and poured water down his back. He presently came to, and said, 35 yards without a rest? But why ask? Since murder was that man's intention, why should he palter with small details? But mark you one thing. In my fall the world shall see how the chivalry of France meets death. After a long silence he asked, was nothing said about that man's family standing up with him, as an offset to my bulk? But no matter, I would not stoop to make such a suggestion. If he is not noble enough to suggest it himself, he is welcome to this advantage, which no honorable man would take. He now sank into a sort of stupor of reflection, which lasted some minutes, after which he broke silence with, the hour, what is the hour fixed for the collision? Dawn, tomorrow. He seemed greatly surprised, and immediately said, insanity. I never heard of such a thing. Nobody is abroad at such an hour. That is the reason I named it. Do you mean to say you want an audience? It is no time to bandy words. I am astonished that M. Fertu should ever have agreed to so strange an innovation. Go at once, and require a later hour. I ran downstairs, threw open the front door, and almost plunged into the arms of M. Fertu's second. He said, I have the honor to say that my principal strenuously objects to the hour chosen, and begs you will consent to change it to 9:30. Any courtesy, sir, which it is in our power to extend, is at the service of your excellent principal. We agree to the proposed change of time. I beg you to accept the thanks of my client. Then he turned to a person behind him, and said, you hear, M. Noir, the hour is altered to 9:30. Whereupon M. Noir bowed, expressed his thanks, and went away. My accomplice continued, if agreeable to you, your chief surgeons and ours shall proceed to the field in the same carriage as is customary. It is entirely agreeable to me, and I am obliged to you for mentioning the surgeons, for I am afraid I should not have thought of them. How many shall I want? I suppose 2 or 3 will be enough. 2 is the customary number for each party. I refer to chief surgeons. But considering the exalted positions occupied by our clients, it will be well and decorous that each of us appoint several consulting surgeons, from among the highest in the profession. These will come in their own private carriages. Have you engaged a hearse? Bless my stupidity, I never thought of it. I will attend to it right away. I must seem very ignorant to you. But you must try to overlook that, because I have never had any experience of such a swell duel as this before. I have had a good deal to do with duels on the Pacific coast, but I see now that they were crude affairs. A hearse show, we used to leave the elected lying around loose, and let anybody court them up, and cart them off that wanted to. Have you anything further to suggest? Nothing, except that the head undertakers shall ride together, as is usual. The subordinates and mutes will go on foot, as is also usual. I will see you at 8:00 in the morning, and we will then arrange the order of the procession. I have the honor to bid you a good day. I returned to my client, who said, very well, at what hour is the engagement to begin? 9:30. Very good indeed. Have you sent the fact to the newspapers? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.